There's a rain date on June 22nd. Owen Foote is a urban planner and environmental advocate, and he'll give a safety presentation, discussion, and guided tour of the canal. Even if you've never been on a canoe before. Now, this is a $350 value. It's yours for a $200 donation. The number of canoes is limited. Donate to Ecologic and WBAI to join us. Give to WBAI.org or call 516-620-3602.
Too Raw for Radio, WBAI's monthly benefit comedy show, will be on Monday, June 4th, and the first Monday of every month from here on. The show is at 7 p.m., and your $13 admission fee helps WBAI. Come for comedy, raffles, and fun. That's Monday, June 4th, at 7 p.m. for Too Raw for Radio, Comedy at the Commons, Brooklyn, located at 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. Just three stops from Manhattan on the A train. Too Raw for Radio, June 4th at 7 p.m.
Find us on Facebook at Too Raw for Radio, WBAI's only comedy show. June 4th at 7 p.m. at the Brooklyn Commons.
Now, if they could only do that without popping their peas and stuff like that. You are tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. And the preceding program was pre-recorded. The machine that was monitoring, that was setting up the broadcast, ended about 45 seconds early by the clock in this room, which I'm going to have to accept is fairly accurate. Look at my clock. Yep. It's matching my phone, on which I rely for just so much. Stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf coming your way in 2, 1. Let's howl. Oh, by the way, no Facebook today. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. About 40 years ago on this program, we did the American premiere broadcast, yes, it was slightly illegal, of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Friday is Towel Day. Don't panic. Just stay tuned. The basic story is that about 40 years ago, I don't remember exactly when, our station manager, Larry Josephson, got a phone call for either directly from a gentleman by the name of Douglas Adams or else from somebody representing the BBC. WBAI had a long association with the BBC. We were the station that broadcast The Goon Show and carried some BBC news items and things like that. But then along came other financial opportunities for the BBC, including NPR. And NPR was, compared to WBAI or Pacifica, very well funded, and Pacifica could not pay the rates. Well, a gentleman who was a producer for the BBC, he worked on a television show called Doctor Who. He was what today we would call the showrunner, but in their lingo, he was the script writer, or script editor, sorry. And Douglas spoke to Larry Josephson, and Josephson is saying to himself, science fiction, give it to Freund. And so I got to meet Douglas Adams. He came on Hour of the Wolf. And in order to play these discs that we had of The Goon Show and so forth, you had to have a very specific turntable. It was proprietary to subscribers of the BBC service. And Douglas, on his night shift, while he was doing Doctor Who during the day, created The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, arguably my favorite radio drama show, not counting things done by the Firesign Theater. So I had Douglas on the show, and when he left the station, somehow he accidentally, see the fingers wiggling, accidentally left 6 BBC discs, which only we could play. And thus, we got to premiere The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I'm going to talk about more of that after the Eagles are done. Journey of the Sorcerer by the Eagles from their album One of These Nights. In those days, I was not a big listener to the Eagles, and I had already been more than a little familiar with Hitchhiker. And imagine my shock, imagine my surprise when one time I put an Eagles album on, because I like their sound, why not? And all of a sudden, it's like, why are they taking this music from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? Stupid me. Okay. But now we all know. Wonderful, wonderful piece of music and wonderful piece of radio drama. So I was telling the story of Douglas coming to WBAI and what he did for us. Now, actually, you know, I have an announcement to make, and it's going to take about two or three minutes. So before I continue this story, and then we'll treat us all to an episode or two or three to The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. We are going to... Did I really fail to... I guess I really did. Failed to publish a particular bio for our next thing. So I have to go to my website, pardon me, while I type away. This is why we're not doing a Facebook Live this morning. Most of the show will be pre-recorded. You can't hear that on Facebook Live anyway. So it would just be me chatting at you and not paying attention to the broadcast. And so there will be times, especially when I have guests, and we will have one next week. Mimi Mondal will be here. And it didn't seem like it was the right night for it. So, you're stuck with radio. And we hope you enjoy it. The next New York Review of Science Fiction Readings will be in 13 days from now, June 5th. And it will be a tribute to Thomas M. Dish. Tom was a semi-regular guest on Hour of the Wolf in the beginning. Margot Adler brought him here any number of times for Hour of the Wolf when I was her co-host every Thursday and Friday and her engineer most days. But she also had him on occasionally on Mondays. And on Mondays, her occasional co-host guest was Mike Hodel, who later on went on to do the science fiction radio program Hour 25. Never mind that he was a news director here at WBAI, or for that matter, he became a news director at KPFA during a time, I guess, when Paul Fisher, Paul, if you're listening, let me know, would have been news director at KPFA, sorry. I know that Hodel was in Hollywood, so he would have been at KPFK. Maybe they're in different years, or maybe they were working together at that point. They would have both been at BAI at the same time, and I think they were both in the L.A. station, unless Paul was in San Francisco. Paul's probably in San Francisco. And, that's another wonderfully, wonderful riveted story. Okay. So Tom Dish was a fairly regular guest. He continued to be that after Margot went to the Clarion Science Fiction Writers Workshop and I became the sole host of Hour of the Wolf. That would be about 1973, 74. I thought it was 74. But somebody who would know, because he went to Clarion with Margot, same year as Margot, and knows darn well what year he graduated Clarion. And that's when I would have taken the show over. So that pushed everything back a year. So Tom was a fairly regular guest on the show, right through the early 1980s. And I know that was the early 80s because by that time, WBAI had moved from the church on East 62nd Street all the way over to 505 8th Avenue, which was intended to be a temporary home, but we were there like 20 years. It was a good place. It just wasn't the church. And, oh, I tell this story because Tom one time was scheduled to come on the program and usually, you know, would meet him at like, you know, 4 a.m. at a coffee shop or else, you know, just come into the station. He certainly knew his way here, ring the bell, ring the buzzer, let you in. He actually showed up for a show or two unannounced because he enjoyed doing it. And he just didn't show, and he didn't show, and he didn't show. So I called him, and finally he answers his phone. This is before cell phones. He answers his phone finally about noon or so. I hadn't gotten to sleep. I was worried. I was honestly worried. I called a couple of people, including Samuel R. Delaney, who's good enough friends with Tom, and Delaney more or less said, you know, don't have to worry about Tom. So when I finally get through to Tom, I said, what happened? Are you okay? He says, yeah, I'm fine. What's the matter with you? There are a few words I don't say on the air without giving disclaimer first. And I said, you were supposed to be on the air this morning. We confirmed it only 2 or 3 days ago. I said, yeah, I figured, you know, hey, what's the point of doing a show at 5 a.m.? Who the hell would be listening? Thereby invalidating my life, more or less. Well, and that was the last that I spoke with him for a long, long time, as in, over 15 years. I didn't enjoy that. I had gone around town recording him at various venues. He was at the New York Review of Science Fiction readings. As a matter of fact, he was in the very second one ever, along with Delaney, as a matter of fact. And good reader, nice guy, strange guy. He hung around the station a great deal. Before the church, there was a brownstone on 39th Street, East 39th Street. And that's where I first met him, when Bert Searles was running the drama and literature department. And the hangers-on, the people who hung out there, included Tom Dish, Samuel R. Delaney, who was producing his radio drama, The Star Pit, a fellow by the name of Theodore Sturgeon, and an intern working for Baird, who has produced a few radio pieces on her own, but also for The Star Pit was credited as the script girl, Joanna Russ. You can imagine for a 13-year-old, or maybe I'm 14 by that time, just how heady that all was. So that's how long I had known Tom. Within the course of doing the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, Henry Wessels, who is an antiquarian bookseller and a writer and an expert on, well, let's say it's since the Douglas Adams morning, life, the universe, and everything. Henry helped create the idea of doing tributes. We've done quite a few now. I think the very first one was Henry putting together one for Avram Davidson. Since then, we've also done James Tiptree Jr., Robert Sheckley. I have to put together a list. But the Avram Davidson one, Henry, who always brings brilliant people, brought along Tom Dish. So this would be the first time I would see Dish in years. I said, yeah, okay. And at this point, the reading series was held at the South Street Seaport. And if you Google up the name Tom Dish and take a look for photographs, you'll find a lot of the photographs were taken either by myself or my partner, Barbara Krasnoff, from that reading. They seem to have become the photograph of record for him. And he was delightful. He was wonderful. He was back to his old self. I invited him to do a reading. He did a reading. It was wonderful. He read with Karen Russell, best known for her fiction and nonfiction work at The New Yorker. And when I told Karen Russell, oh, you're going to be reading this guy, Tom Dish, Well, who is he? Oh, well, he wrote a lot of short stories, had a number of collections. He wrote Camp Concentration. He wrote 334, On Wings of Song. He wrote some brilliant stuff. Oh, yeah, he wrote some horrors, gothic anyway, such as The Priest and The Businessman. And he even wrote a juvenile entitled The Brave Little Toaster, and she went happy on me. He wrote The Brave Little Toaster. Oh, my God, I read that when I was a little girl. That was my favorite book, and it was my favorite movie. The movie, by the way, was made by a fellow at Disney named John Lasseter, and it did no business whatsoever, and Disney wasn't too fond of having John Lasseter around, and they fired him. Several years later, he came back to Disney and took over the animation department with a company that he co-founded called Pixar, from which he is temporarily on leave. What will happen to Pixar is, or rather to John Lasseter's career at Pixar, is in the air. He apparently has issues. Let's not get into that. You just look up John Lasseter, you'll read about it. The point is Tom Dish, and this wonderful reading he did with Karen Russell. I've played the recording a few times. I'll play it again real soon now. And he read from a book called The Word of God, or Holy Writ Rewritten. And he tells it first person, and he is God. And he represented himself at the reading as God. And when he got up, he was heavy. He had a lot of pain. He had sciatica and a few other issues. And he said, okay, those who want blessings, humans, please get on the left. If you want your pets to be blessed, please line them up on the right. I will make sure that they behave. Oh, no pets? I'm surprised. He was charming. He was wonderful. He read from that book. And I felt very, very good. So I asked him, so it's been like getting on to 20 years, not quite, but you want to do another episode of Hour of the Wolf? He said, yeah, sure. Haven't done that in years. I said, well, look, I've already got this reading of yours. You don't have to come into the station and read live at 5 a.m. I will come to your place with my portable recorder. And we'll record about an hour's worth of stuff, and that, along with your reading, is going to give me a radio show. He said, fine, but listen, this was early June. Let's not, give me some time. Wait until just after the 4th of July. Give me a call just after the 4th of July. And so I did. I waited, that is to say. This is 10 years ago. On the 4th of July, 2008, he shot himself. And he darned well knew he was going to do it when he told me to call him afterward. I've been in touch with a fellow does brilliant podcast and some radio drama by the name of Everett Champion, who is doing some current focusing on Dish. And according to him, he did what was the last interview with Tom, which I believe. So that was Tom Dish. In the memorial for him, there were so many people who did not want to be the speaker for the dead in that case. At one point or another, with the possible exception of Delaney, and he did stuff to Delaney, but Delaney just let it pass. David Hartwell, not so much, and a few other people. So at some point or another, Tom really, pissed off people. And yet, he was beloved. And the stuff that he left behind him is an amazing legacy of literature. So, June 5th. almost 10 years to the day that Tom Dish came to the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings to do a tribute for the late Avram Davidson. This June 5th, Henry Wessels is producing a tribute for Thomas M. Dish. How appropriate is all that? So I had to tell the whole story and show you how it dovetailed together. And for the people who are going to be the celebrants for the occasion, Brendan C. Byrne, who's read for us once before, he was actually requested to read by his co-reader, Rudy Rucker. Brendan C. Byrne's criticism has appeared in Rhizome, The Baffler, and The Intercept, among other organs. They wrote this, I didn't. His fiction has appeared in Empirica, Big Echo, Terraform, Dark Mountain, Flapper House, and Flurb. I love those names. John Clute, this is all in alphabetical order. I hope that you note. John Clute, reviewer, critic, encyclopedia writer, author, variously. Appleseed in 2001 is an SF novel. The first version of the Encyclopedia of Science Fiction was published in 1979 and continues in an online version today at sf-encyclopedia.com. Other nonfiction includes The Darkening Garden, A Short Lexicon of Horror, and Part of This Intrusion, Fantastica in the World Storm. John became friends with Dish in 61 and continued until Tom's death. So I'm sure that Clute will be another person who did not have a bad relationship with Tom at one point or another. But we'll find that out in 2 weeks when we are all assembled. Gregory Feely is the literary executor for Tom Dish, and he will be present. Greg Feely writes science fiction and about science fiction. His first novel, The Oxygen Barons, was nominated for the Philip K. Dick Award. Oh, I have to mention Dick in a moment. And his short fiction has been frequently anthologized, most recently The Beers, Yeast, Science Fiction and Fantasy, 2017. He recently completed a new novel and is preparing an edition of Dish's Best Short Fiction. Reason I have to mention Philip K. Dick is in that book, The Word of God. As Dish is God, there is a point in the book when the earth opens up and the minions of hell come out, led by their leader, Philip K. Dick. And Thomas M. Dish and Philip K. Dick do a battle for the fate of the cosmos. That is the premise of Dish's last novel, okay? Talk about meta. Also present will be Elizabeth Hand, and she is the multi-award-winning author of 14 novels and 4 collections of short fiction. Her reviews, essays, and articles have appeared in numerous places, including The Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, Boston Review, The Village Voice, Salon, Real Simple, and The Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. Her forthcoming novel, Curious Toys, inspired by the work of outsider artist Henry Darger, I believe it's Darger and not Darger, Darger, and the unsolved 1915 murder of 5-year-old Elsie Perubek, will be out next year. Also present will be Eric Saulstein, who made a movie, Winter Journey, of Tom reading his poetry, and Eric will introduce some clips from that for 5 to 7 minutes. And Terrence Taylor, our friend Terrence Taylor, is going to do a couple of readings of Tom Dish's work, including, I have determined, the first, and that will be Fun With Your New Head, which Frank Heller and I did an audio drama version of it, and something later, possibly from On Wings of Song, Henry Wessels will, of course, be choosing that segment. So this is going to be a wonderful, wonderful event, And we want you to come to 388 Atlantic Avenue between Hoyt and Bond Street. That's in Brooklyn. It's the Brooklyn Commons Cafe. It's also WBAI, but don't go to the third floor. Go to the main floor with a lovely cafe that seats, 100 people and more. And that's where the event will be taking place. So June 5th, almost the 10th anniversary of Dishes Reading. For us, again, 388 Atlantic Avenue between Hoyt and Bond. There are so many ways to get there. It's very easy to get to. There are about as many trains, more trains perhaps, than there are that go to Times Square. So come by. Admission is free. Donations accepted. The donations go to the reading series, not to WBAI, although I'm quite willing to put out a tin can for WBAI donations. And I want you, speaking of which, to become a BAI buddy. Tom Dish certainly would have said you ought to be a BAI buddy, and so would Douglas Adams. Douglas, every time he came to the U.S., or at least to New York, became a guest on Hour of the Wolf. It was delightful to see him. I think I had him on a total of about 4 times. Last time was actually when he had put out his wonderful and bizarre interactive fiction game with graphics. Tom Dish, by the way, was a pioneer in interactive fiction. And Douglas did some too, with his company called The Digital Village, or TDV. And it was called Starship Titanic. We actually had about 10 copies, and I cannot begin to express my displeasure. They were all autographed, and we gave them away when you became a subscriber to BAI. There we were premium. And when we were at our last location on Wall Street, so that's actually 2 locations ago, there was a room with the 3 box sets left autographed by Douglas, and somebody threw them out. Somebody thought, oh, these are taking up too much room. I dare say one of those today would go for $500, $600 on eBay easily. Somebody just threw them out. You can imagine my annoyance, because this is several years ago, and I'm still bitching about it. But nonetheless, Douglas did a lot to help WBAI. He made us the first broadcaster of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So many people think that Hitchhikers is a book. Even when I posted I was going to be playing it, people said, oh, I love that book. Well, okay, I'm glad you loved that book. It's a wonderful book, and most of the sequels, not all the sequels, most of the sequels are wonderful. But it was a radio drama. It was intended to be a radio drama. It's one of the best radio dramas ever made. At least the first fit, as Douglas called them. There was Fit the Second, and then after Douglas's death, Dirk Maggs, I believe his name is, went on to do 3 more. And there's something about a 6th fit that most people don't recommend. I got lost with the 3rd one because most of the jokes, most of the gags, and the plot had to do with cricket. I know Bupkis about cricket. So I didn't get it. It wasn't football even, you know, it wasn't rugby or anything like that. It was cricket. Dunno. All I can say is I didn't get it. It was a little too Brit for me. Now, let's see. There have been several versions of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. There was first, of course, the radio drama. Then there was a BBC TV series, which had the original cast, Simon Jones, and so forth. And it was quite good. if you don't mind all the very cheesy special effects that were no better than the special effects on Doctor Who, which is to say, they were totally cheesy. We're not talking about the modern Doctor Who. We're talking about the Doctor Who of the late 70s, early 80s, when some duct tape and bubble wrap and spray paint would turn somebody into a monster. And then a painted set behind them, and that was Doctor Who. But they were so much fun, especially Tom Baker years. And with Peter Davison, those were pretty good. They started getting a little mean. And in the late 80s, the show was canceled and then revived in 2005. You know that whole story. But why was I getting into Doctor Who now? Well, just that Douglas was the head writer at that time. And he used a group that put together a form of avant-garde music, musique concrète. And this involved revolutionary early electronic music. The music director of WBAI at that time was a gentleman by the name of Mike Saul, who I only learned like 2 days ago, passed away about 2 months ago, and I'm going to have to try to get some recordings, and I'll tell my memories of Mike on some other day. But I've mentioned the Free Music Store a couple of times, and Mike was, if not the person who created it, instrumental in doing that, along with Eric Salzman. And his loss is a great one. So, and I will find, I vow I will find the famous WBAI Michael Saul Golden Record hoax. But that's another story. These things all dovetail, and I have so many of these tales. Okay. So first, the radio series. Next, the TV show. Then there was a play, a Fringe. To us, that would be off-Broadway or off-off-Broadway. That was well-received, but not the kind of thing that would come to the States of Hitchhiker. And eventually, finally, a movie. Now, Douglas was preparing a movie. He was shopping it, as a matter of fact, to Disney. And he was in California to present his script. And he wanted certain stars, and he wanted various people attached. It was to be an all-star production. And then one day, while he was in California, he worked out in the gym. He went there. He was very, very, very annoyed at Apple. Now, Douglas was a huge Apple aficionado. He dedicates one of his books to the Macintosh. And if you watch the movie, we'll get into the movie in a moment, you will notice that the big computer, which we will be hearing this morning, the big computer is a Mac. Charming touch. Charming touch. So, the way I have heard the story is that he answers the door and Steve Jobs is at the door, apologizing for the fact that Apple turned down Douglas's capability to turn his latest work of interactive fiction into something applicable to the Macintosh. And since Douglas was such a Macintosh fan, fanatic, this was very upsetting to him. They wanted fees to check it out. Apple is, this was the way that, very much so that Apple was, and to a certain extent still is. So Jobs got a hold of this. He knew how important to their little industry, it's not so little, Douglas Adams was. A major promoter, a fan, a great creator, and somebody who they wanted to be on his good side. and later on that afternoon, Douglas went back down to the gym and fell dead. He was taken very young and unexpectedly. It was really a what? I mean, with Tom Dish, we actually, many of us knew of his suicidal tendencies. I had seen him toting a gun in his apartment more than once, and at parties, I should mention. And usually a lot of people, myself included, just left his point, just left his house at that point. And similar, but Douglas was in perfect health, but he died in 2001. He was approximately two and a half years younger than me. So he would be, 65, 66 today. And just, well, nothing to be said about that. It was sad. It was very sad. So, but what was good was I don't think Douglas's script of the movie Hitchhikers was going to be that great. And it wasn't until many years later that a movie was finally made. Oh, did I leave out that there was a... Yeah, I know. I mentioned and then got off track again. That Douglas wrote for Infocom a game version text adventure of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And he also did a game, I played this game, I spent many hours loving it, and the name will occur to me in a little while when I'm off air, but I'll remember it and write it down before we're done. Douglas also wrote, in intervening time, Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency, and the sequel, The Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul, and the meaning, he co-wrote The Meaning of Life. He did a lot of work with various Python people, and including on that game, the Starship Titanic with Terry Jones. And various Python people supplied the voices for that computer game. I'm seeing in Wikipedia it says a computer game. Wrong. Three computer games. So, anyway, how could Wikipedia be wrong about anything? So, Douglas was a very accomplished person, a wonderful speaker, a bon vivant. Many of you are probably familiar with episodes 1 and 2 of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which starts with Arthur Dent holding his towel. Oh, did I mention that Friday is Towel Day? It is. It is Towel Day because of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Let me look that one up, see who online might have words about Towel Day. It's very important, like, Speak Like a Pirate Day and things like that. Yes, towelday.org, May 25th, an annual tribute to the works of Douglas Adams. Last week on this show, when I was asking listeners, I have this to play or that to play, and a woman called up. And we had a wonderful conversation on the air, and she was advocating Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I did not, because I realized I had to play Peter S. Beagle, because in the Nebula Awards, which I'll talk about in another week, they were held this past weekend, on the Nebulas, they they made Peter S. Beagle the Grandmaster, and so I played the majority of an interview that I did with him. Had to cut it off at the end because, well, as you can tell, I like to talk, and I went on a little bit too long. Those people, by the way, who missed the very end of that and want to hear the very end of that, I can make it available to you secretly if you send me an email at Jim, J-I-M, at ourwolf.com, H-O-U-R-W-O-L-F.com, or you can send me a message on Facebook if we're friended. If we're not friended, you can't. Although you can go into the Hour of the Wolf group and just give me your email address there if you're willing to put your email address on Facebook, which is a questionable thing. Just send me an email. That's best. And again, Jim at ourwolf.com. So, and then I told this woman, oh, send me an email and I'll let you know when I'm going to play Hitchhikers. I went home, and about 3 hours after the show, I looked at my calendar and saw May 25th, Towel Day. Duh. I should have scheduled this show for Douglas Adams' show to begin with. And unfortunately, that woman never sent me an email. So I hope she's listening this morning. I hope you are listening this morning, because this is for you and this is for Douglas. Okay, episode one, Arthur Dent. One of his friends, a fellow by the name of Ford Prefect, comes over to his house and prepares him. Says, you know, you have to eat some peanuts, you have to do this, you have to do that, and you have to get rather drunk so we can hitchhike off of Earth. And it's like, you know, what are you talking about? He said, well, Earth is being, you know, turned into a highway, into a byway, an intergalactic byway. So, not quite understanding, while Arthur is lying in front of a bulldozer that wants to knock down his house, Arthur gets up, P.S., they knock down his house moments later, goes with Ford to a bar, gets some beers, gets some peanuts, and get picked up by a Vogon ship. They are captured by the Vogon ship, and in episode two, they are tortured, severely tortured, by the captain of the Vogon ship, reading them Vogon poetry. A lot of the charm of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy are the asides, the talking about, you know, where bad poetry occurs. There are these constant asides that the narrator comes up with. It's beautifully done. And that's, for the most part, the contents of episodes one and two. There was a decent movie made out of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It went, arguably a little bit astray at a certain point, involving a thing that went on with John Malkovich playing a strange alien. But overall, I enjoyed it a great deal. I thought that Douglas was a little too close to the material, frankly, and that his script was better. The script of the film that was done, I think, was a little bit better than the one that Douglas would have done. Let me see if I can find. I'm blanking on the name of the director of the movie. I'm looking at Wikipedia when what I should be looking at, here we are, is IMDb. But, yes, and the movie starred Martin Freeman, Sam Rockwell, Mos Def, Zooey Deschanel, and Stephen Fry and Alan Rickman doing voices. Stephen Fry was the narrator, and Alan Rickman was Marvin the Paranoid Android. Okay, so, and I do recommend the movie. Flawed though it may be, it's a lot of fun. So, let's see, it still hasn't told me who the darn director is. Maybe I'm looking too quickly. The first director asked to do the film and would have been fine was Spike Jonze. Why am I not seeing it here? Well, you know what? I'll tell you between episodes. I shouldn't be sitting around surfing on the web and talking to you at the same time. I love episodes 3 and 4. I'm not saying they're better than 1 and 2, but it's okay to come into them cold. And these are my favorite to play. I am sorry that the copy of Hitchhikers that I have is not pristine. It has the kind of artifacts that are not uncommon with MP3 sound, but we will make do with it. And I'm just waiting for it to queue up now. And it will introduce itself, or rather Peter Jonze. Wait, is Peter Jonze the narrator? Well, he's certainly the book. So, okay, I'm double-clicking this, not coming up, why not? It will, I know it will. Ah, there we are. Okay, so with no further ado, episode 3 of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And then we will talk a little bit more and do episode 4. But not to forget, this radio show premiered on WBAI. Tom Dish was a friend to WBAI. Become a BAI buddy. $10 a month, $25 a month, pay what you will, but become a buddy and do that by going to give2wbai.org. Again, that's give2wbai.org or calling 516-620-3602. If you have any connectivity problems, again, send an email to jfreund@ourwolf.com and I will do what I can. So, once again, introducing this.
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams, starring Peter Jonze as The Book.
I promise you, the next time I play this, it'll be a cleaner copy. Oh yeah, we broadcast this 3 years before NPR.
Far back in the mists of ancient time, in the great and glorious days of the former Galactic Empire, life was wild, rich, and on the whole, tax-free. In those days, spirits were brave, the stakes were high, men were real men, women were real women, and small furry creatures from Alpha Centauri were real small furry creatures from Alpha Centauri. And all dared to brave unknown terrors, to do mighty deeds, to boldly split infinitives that no man had split before. And thus was the Empire forged. Many men, of course, became extremely rich. But this was perfectly natural and nothing to be ashamed of, because no one was really poor, at least no one worth speaking of. And for these extremely rich merchants, life eventually became rather dull, and it seemed that none of the worlds they settled on was entirely satisfactory. Either the climate wasn't quite right in the later part of the afternoon, or the day was half an hour too long, or the sea was just the wrong shade of pink. And thus were created the conditions for a staggering new form of industry. Custom-made luxury planet building. The home of this industry was the planet Magrathea, where vast hyperspatial engineering works were constructed to suck matter through white holes in space and form it into dream planets, lovingly made to meet the exacting standards of the galaxy's richest men. And so successful was this venture that very soon Magrathea itself became the richest planet of all time, and the rest of the galaxy was reduced to abject poverty. And so the system broke down, the empire collapsed, and a long, sullen silence settled over the galaxy, disturbed only by the pen-scratchings of scholars as they labored into the night over smug little treatises on the value of a planned political economy. In these enlightened days, of course, no one believes a word of it. Meanwhile, on Zaphod Beeblebrox's ship, deep in the darkness of the Horsehead Nebula, I'm sorry, I just don't believe a word of it.
Listen to me, Ford. I found it. I swear I found it.
Magrathea is a myth, a fairy story. It's what parents tell their kids about at night if they want them to grow up to become economists.
And we are currently in orbit around it.
Zaphod, I can't help what you may personally be in orbit around, but this ship...
Computer! Oh,
no. Hi there, this is Eddie, your shipboard computer, and I'm feeling just great, guys, and I know I'm just going to get a bundle of kicks out of any program you care to run through me.
Is this necessary?
Computer, tell us again what our current trajectory is.
A real pleasure, fella. We are currently in orbit at an altitude of 300 miles around the legendary planet of Magrathea. Golly.
Proving nothing. I wouldn't trust that computer to speak my weight.
I could do that for you, sure.
No, thank you.
I could even work out your personality problems to 10 decimal places if it'll help.
Zaphod, we should have dawn coming up any minute now on the planet, whatever it turns out to be.
Okay, let's just take a look at it. Computer.
Hi there. What can I do
just,
for you?
Just shut up and give us external vision on the monitors.
Tricia, I feel I may be missing the point of something.
Hmm? Well, Arthur, according to what Zaphod's told me, Magrathea is a legendary planet from way back, which no one seriously believes in. A bit like Atlantis, really. Oh, except that the legends say the Magratheans used to manufacture planets.
Hmm. Is there any tea on this spaceship?
Arthur Dent had basically assumed that he was the only native ape-descended Earthman to escape from the planet Earth when it was unexpectedly demolished to make way for a new hyperspace bypass because his only companion, disconcertingly called Ford Prefect, had already revealed himself to be from a small planet somewhere in the vicinity of Betelgeuse and not from Guildford after all. So when, against all conceivable probability, they were suddenly rescued from certain death in deep space by a stolen starship manned by two people, one of whom is Ford's semi-brother, the infamous Zaphod Beeblebrox, and the other of whom is Tricia Macmillan, a rather nicely descended ape person that Arthur once met at a party in Islington, it could only be because the ship was powered by the new infinite improbability drive. Which, of course, it was. Slowly, majestically, this mighty starship begins its long descent towards the surface of the ancient planet, which might or might not be Magrathea.
Well, even supposing it is, which it isn't, what do you want with it anyway? I mean, I take it you're not here for the sheer industrial archaeology of it all. What is it you're after?
Well, it's partly the curiosity, partly a sense of adventure. But mostly I think it's the fame and the money.
It's just a dead planet.
The suspense is killing me.
Stress and nervous tension are now serious social problems in all parts of the galaxy, and it is in order that this situation should not be in any way exacerbated that the following facts will now be revealed in advance. The planet in question is, in fact, Magrathea. The deadly nuclear missile attack shortly to be launched by an ancient automatic defense system will merely result in the bruising of somebody's upper arm and the untimely creation and sudden demise of a bowl of petunias and an innocent sperm whale. In order that some sense of mystery should still be preserved, no revelation will yet be made concerning whose upper arm has been bruised. This fact may safely be made the subject of suspense, since it is of no significance whatsoever. Arthur's next question about the planet is very complex and difficult, and Zaphod's answer is wrong in every important respect.
Is it safe? Magrathea's been dead for 5 million years. Of course it's safe. Even the ghosts will have settled down and raised families by now. What?
My voice.
Computer?
Hi there.
What is it?
Oh, just some 5 million-year-old tape recording that's being broadcast at us.
This is a recorded announcement, but I'm afraid we're all out at the moment. The Commercial Council of Magrathea thanks you for your esteemed visit here, but regrets that the entire planet is temporarily closed for business. Thank you. If you would like to leave your name and a planet where you could be contacted, kindly speak when you hear the tone.
They want to get rid of us. What do we do?
It's just a recording. Keep going. Got that computer?
I got it.
We would like to assure you that as soon as our business is resumed, announcements will be made in all fashionable magazines and color supplements when our clients will once again be able to select from all that's best in contemporary geography. Meanwhile, we thank our clients for their kind interest and would ask them to leave now.
Well, I suppose we'd better be going then, haven't we?
There's absolutely nothing to be worried about.
Then why is everyone so tense?
They're just interested. We keep going.
It is most gratifying that your enthusiasm for our planet continues unabated. And so we would like to assure you that the guided missiles currently converging with your ship are part of a special service we extend to all of our most enthusiastic clients. And the fully armed nuclear warheads are, of course, merely a courtesy detail. We look forward to your custom in future lives. thank you.
Listen, if that's their sales pitch, what must it be like in the complaints department?
Hey, this is terrific. It means we really must be onto something if they're trying to kill us.
Terrific.
You mean there is someone down there after all?
No, the whole defense system must be automatic, but the question is why?
But what are we going to do?
Just keep cool.
Is that all?
No, we're also going to take evasive action. Computer, what evasive action can we take?
None, I'm afraid, guys.
Or something?
There seems to be something jamming my guidance systems. Impact minus 30 seconds. Sorry, I didn't mean to do that. Please call me Eddie if it will help you relax.
Right, look, we've got to get manual control of this ship.
Can you fly her?
No, can you?
No.
Ford?
No.
Fine, we'll do it together.
I can't either.
I'd guess that. Computer, I want full manual control now.
You got it. Good luck, guys. Impact minus 20 seconds.
Okay, Ford, full retro thrust and 10 degrees starboard.
We're veering too fast.
I can't hold us. He's going into a spin.
Dive, dive.
It is, of course, more or less at this point that one of our heroes sustains a slight bruise to the upper arm. This should be emphasized because, as has already been revealed, they escape otherwise completely unharmed, and the deadly nuclear missiles do not eventually hit the ship. Our hero's safety is absolutely assured.
Impact minus 15 seconds, guys.
The rockets are still homing in. You can't shake them. We're going to die.
When you walk through the
storm. Shut that bloody computer up!
Zaphod, can we stabilize at X00547 by splitting our flight path tangentially across the summit vector of 9GX78 with a 5-degree inertial correction?
What? Yes, I expect so. Just do it. And God forgive you if you're any rough on me.
Here we go.
Learn a stunt like that, Trillian?
Going round Hyde Park Corner on a moped.
What?
Oh, it's another.
Yeah, tell me later.
It's no good. The missiles are swinging round after us and gaining fast. We are quite definitely going to die.
Though your dreams be tossed and blown, impact minus 5 seconds.
Why does everyone turn on this improbability drive thing?
Oh, don't be silly. You can't do that.
Why not? There's nothing to lose at this stage.
Well, because. Does anyone know why Arthur can't turn on the improbability drive?
Impact minus 1 second. It's been great knowing you guys. God bless. You are
I said, does anyone know?
I was just saying, there's this switch here, you see.
Where are we, Trillian?
Exactly where we were, I think.
Then what's happened to the missiles?
Well, according to this screen, they've just turned into a bowl of petunias and a very surprised-looking whale.
At an improbability factor of 8,767,128 to 1 against.
Did you think of that, Earthman?
Well, all I did was just
That's
simply...
very good thinking, you know that? You just saved our lives.
Oh, it was nothing, really.
Oh, was it? Oh, well, forget it. Oh. Okay, computer... Take us into land.
Well, I say it was nothing. I mean, obviously it was something. I was just trying to say it's not worth making too much of a fuss about. I mean, just saving everybody's life, you know?
Another thing that no one made too much fuss about was the fact that against all probability, a sperm whale had suddenly been called into existence some miles above the surface of an alien planet. And since this is not a naturally tenable position for a whale, this innocent creature had very little time to come to terms with its identity as a whale before it had to come to terms with suddenly not being a whale anymore. This is what it thought as it fell.
Excuse me, who am I? Hello? Why am I here? What's my purpose in life? What do I mean by who am I?
Now calm down, get a grip now. Oh, this is an interesting sensation. What is it? It's a sort of yawning, tingling sensation in my... Well, I suppose I better start finding names and things if I want to make any headway and what for the sake of what I shall call an argument I shall call the world. So let's call it my stomach. So, a yawning, tingling sensation in my stomach. Good. Oh, it's getting quite strong. Hey, what about this whistling, roaring sound going past what I'm suddenly going to call my head? That can be wind. Is that a good name? Oh, it'll do. Perhaps I can find a better name for it later when I find out what it's for, because there certainly seems to be a hell of a lot of it. Hey, what's this thing? This, let's call it a tail. Yeah, tail. Hey, I can really thrash it about pretty good, can't I? Wow, wow. Hey, doesn't seem to achieve much, but I'll probably find out what it's for later on. Now, have I built up any coherent picture of things yet? No. Oh, hey, this is really exciting. So much to find out about, so much to look forward to. I'm quite dizzy with anticipation. Or is it the wind? Hey, there really is a lot of that now, isn't there? And wow, what's this thing suddenly coming towards me very fast? Very, very fast. So big and flat and wide. It is a big, wide-sounding word like ground. That's it. Ground. I wonder if it'll be friendly though.
Curiously enough, the only thing that went through the mind of the bowl of petunias as it fell was, oh no, not again. Many people have speculated that if we knew exactly why the bowl of petunias had thought that, we should know a lot more about the nature of the universe than we do now. Meanwhile, the starship has landed on the surface of Megrathea, and Trillian is about to make one of the most important statements of her life. Its importance is not immediately recognized by her companions.
Hey, my white mice have escaped.
Oh, nuts to your white mice.
It is possible that Trillian's observation would have commanded greater attention had it been generally realized that human beings were only the third most intelligent life form on the planet Earth, instead of, as was generally thought by most independent observers, the second.
Okay, run atmospheric checks on the planet.
Are we taking this robot?
Don't feel you have to take any notice of me, please.
Oh, Marvin the paranoid android. Yeah, we'll take him.
What are you supposed to do with a manically depressed robot?
You think you've got problems. What are you supposed to do if you are a manically depressed robot? No, don't try and answer that. I'm 50,000 times more intelligent than you, and even I don't know the answer. It gives me a headache just trying to think down to your level.
Well, what's the result? Okay, everybody, let's go.
Good afternoon, boys.
What's that?
Oh, that's just the computer. I discovered it had an emergency backup personality, which I thought might be marginally preferable.
Now, this is going to be your first day on a strange planet, so I want you all wrapped up, snug and warm, and no playing with any naughty, bug-eyed monsters.
I'm sorry, I think we might have been better off with a slide rule.
Right, who said that?
Will you open up the exit hatch, please, computer?
Nothing to whoever said that owns up.
Oh, God.
Come on.
Computer.
I'm waiting. I can wait all day.
Computer, if you don't open that exit hatch this moment, I shall go straight to your major data banks with a very large axe and give you a reprogramming you'll never forget. Is that clear?
I can see this relationship is something we're all going to have to work at.
Thank you. Let's go.
It'll all end in tears, I know it.
Desolate hole, if you ask me.
Oh, it's bloody cold. It all looks so stark and dreary.
I think it's absolutely fantastic. It's only just getting through to me. A whole alien world. Millions of light years from home. Pity it's such a dump, though.
Hey, just beyond that ridge you can see the remains of an ancient city.
What does it look like?
Well, it's a bit of a dump. Come on over. Oh, and watch out for all the bits of whale meat.
Do you realize that robot can hum like Pink Floyd? What else can you do, Marvin?
Rock and roll.
I wish I knew where my mice were.
I found a way in.
In? In what?
Down to the interior of the planet. That's where we have to go. Where no man has trod these 5 million years. Into the very depths of time itself. Well, can it, Marvin?
Why underground?
Well, according to the legends, the Megratheans live most of their lives underground.
Did the surface become too polluted or overpopulated?
No, I think they just didn't like it very much.
Seyfod, are you sure you know what you're doing? We've been attacked once already, you know.
Look, I promise you, the live population of this planet is nil plus the four of us.
And two white mice.
And two white mice, if you insist.
Oh, come on, let's go if we're going.
Earthman.
Arthur.
Could you sort of keep the robot with you and guard this end of the passageway, okay?
Guard? What from? You've just said there's no one here.
Yeah, well, just for safety, okay?
Whose? Yours or mine?
Yeah, good lad. Okay, here we go.
Well, I hope you all have a really miserable time.
Don't worry, they will.
It's really spooky.
Look at all this. Galleries of derelict equipment just lying about. Does anyone know what happened to this place in the end? I mean, why did the Megratheans die out?
Something to do, I suppose.
If I had two heads like you, Zephyr, I could have hours of fun banging them against a wall.
Hey, shine the torch over there.
Where? Here?
Well, we aren't the first beings to go down this corridor in 5 million years, then.
What do you mean?
Look, fresh mouse droppings.
Oh, you're bloody mice.
What's that light down the corridor?
It's just a torch reflection.
There's definitely something happening down there.
No.
Listen.
Light's falling. Look, robot, the stars are coming out.
I know. Wretched, isn't it?
But that sunset. I've never seen anything like it in my wildest dreams. The two suns. It was like mountains of fire boiling into space.
I've seen it. It's rubbish.
We only ever had the one sun at home. I came from a planet called Earth, you know.
I know. You keep going on about it. It sounds awful.
Oh, no. It was a beautiful place.
Did it have oceans?
Oh, yes. Great, wide, rolling, blue oceans.
Can't bear oceans.
Tell me, do you get on well with other robots?
Haven. Where are you going?
I just think I'll take a short walk.
Don't blame you.
Good evening.
Who?
You choose a cold night to visit our dead planet?
Who are you?
My name is not important.
You startled me.
Do not be alarmed. I will not harm you. But
you shot at us. There were missiles.
Merely an automatic system. Ancient computers ranged in the long caves deep in the bowels of the planet tick away the dark millennia. I think they take the occasional pot shot to relieve the monotony. I'm a great fan of science, you know.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Ah.
You seem ill at ease.
Yes, well, no disrespect, but I gathered you were all dead.
Dead? No, we have but slept.
Slept?
Yes, through the economic recession, you see.
What?
Well, 5 million years ago, the galactic economy collapsed. And seeing that custom-built planets are something of a luxury commodity, you know we built planets,
oh,
do you?
Well, yes, I'd sort of gathered.
Fascinating trade. Doing the coastlines was always my favorite. Used to have endless fun doing all the little fiddly bits in fjords. Anyway, the recession came, so we decided to sleep through it. We just programmed the computers to revive us when it was all over. They were index-linked to the galactic stock market prices, you see, so that we'd be revived when everybody else had rebuilt the economy enough to be able to afford our rather expensive services again.
Good God, that's a pretty unpleasant way to behave, isn't it?
Is it? I'm sorry, I'm a bit out of touch. You must come with me. Great things are afoot. You must come now or you will be late.
Late? What for?
What is your name, human?
Dent, Arthur Dent.
Late, as in the late Dent Arthur Dent. It's a sort of threat, you see. Never been very good at them myself, but I'm told they could be terribly effective.
All right, where do we go?
In my air car. We are going deep into the bowels of the planet, where even now our race is being revived from its 5 million year slumber.
Excuse me? What is your name, by the way?
My name is Slati Bartfast.
I beg your pardon?
Slati Bartfast.
Slati Bartfast?
I said it wasn't important.
It is an important and popular fact that things are not always what they seem. For instance, on the planet Earth, man had always assumed that he was more intelligent than dolphins because he'd achieved so much, the Wheel, New York, wars and so on, whilst all the dolphins had ever done was muck about in the water having a good time. But conversely, the dolphins believed that they were more intelligent than man for precisely the same reasons. Curiously enough, the dolphins had long known of the impending demolition of Earth and had made many attempts to alert mankind to the danger, but most of their communications were misinterpreted as amusing attempts to punch footballs or whistle for titbits, so they eventually gave up and left the Earth by their own means, shortly before the Vogons arrived. The last ever dolphin message was misinterpreted as a surprisingly sophisticated attempt to do a double backward somersault through a hoop whilst whistling the Star Spangled Banner. In fact, the message was this: so long, and thanks for all the fish. In fact, There was only one species on the planet more intelligent than dolphins, and they spent a lot of their time in behavioral research laboratories running round inside wheels and conducting frighteningly elegant and subtle experiments on man.
Earthman, we are now deep in the heart of Magrathea. I should warn you that the chamber we are about to pass into does not literally exist within our planet. It is simply the gateway into a vast tract of hyperspace. It may disturb you.
Oh.
It scares the willies out of me. Hold tight. Welcome to our factory floor.
The light.
This is where we make most of our planets, you see.
Does this mean you're starting it all up again now?
No, for heaven's sake. The galaxy isn't nearly rich enough to support us yet. No, we've been awakened to perform just one extraordinary commission. It may interest you. There, in the distance in front of us.
Oh, no.
You see?
The Earth?
Well, the Earth Mark II, in fact. It seems that the first one was demolished 5 minutes too early, and the most vital experiment was destroyed. There's been a terrible hoo-ha, and so we're going to make a copy from our original blueprints.
Are you saying that you originally made the Earth?
Oh, yes. Did you ever go to a place... I think it's called Norway.
What? No, I didn't.
Pity, that was one of mine. Won an award, you know. Lovely, crinkly edges.
I can't take this. Did I hear you say the Earth was destroyed 5 minutes too early?
Shocking cock-up. The mice were furious.
Mice?
Yes, the whole thing was their experiment, you see. A 10-million-year research program to find the ultimate question. Big job, you know.
Look, would it save you all this bother if I just gave up and went mad now?
Has Slartibart Fast flipped his lid? Are Ford, Zaphod and Trillian dying in fearful agony? Or have they simply slipped out for a quick meal somewhere? Will Arthur Dent feel better with a good hot drink inside him? Find out in next week's exciting installment of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
In that episode of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Peter Jones was the book. Richard Vernon was Slartibart Fast. Simon Jones played Arthur Dent and Geoffrey McGiven, Ford Prefect. Stephen Moore was Marvin, Mark Wing Davy, Zaphod Beeblebrox, Susan Sheridan, Trillian, and David Tate, Computer. The programme was written by Douglas Adams and produced by Geoffrey Perkins with the assistance of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. Zaphod Beeblebrox is now appearing in No Sex Please, We're Amoeboid Zingatularians at the Brantesvogen Starhouse.
I'm sorry, but I'd probably be able to cope better if I hadn't bruised my arm.
And here at WBAI, we could bruise our arms if you don't call and pledge, which we would like you to do. Or you don't have to call and pledge. You can go to givetowbai.org. And become a BAI buddy. Douglas would have done it. Actually, Douglas donated a great deal to WBAI. So, I have to deeply, deeply apologize. I listened to these quickly as I left the house, and I did not realize what crappy MP3s I had. I pledge unto you that I will, by crook or by hook, get a... proper copy, given that I once had pristine copies that Douglas gave me on vinyl of the very original. This is probably derived from an air check from the NPR version, because these run 25 minutes long. The versions that WBAI broadcast were 31 minutes long, something that only Max Schmid understood why, and I forgot his explanation, why any radio show would be more than 30 minutes long and not like 45 or something like 31 minutes, really? But that's what they wrote for. I think what it was is that at the BBC, they were a little bit looser, the way that actually WBAI used to be. We would very often put 45-minute shows or 50-minute shows into a one-hour slot, and then the 5 or 10 minutes would either take up the slack for the shows that ran over or for what we called a miscellany, where the announcer on duty, who nowadays would be called, say, Michael G. Haskins, where the announcer on duty could just, you know, play what they wished. So, you know, Gary Fried, Mark Spector, Lynn Samuels, Mickey Waldman, all these various people, and myself, we all took great advantage of such miscellanies. So again, I'm very, very sorry for the quality, but I trust, especially for first-time listeners to Hitchhikers, at least you're picking up on the brilliance of the humor. So I don't know, by the way, why that recording stopped just before goodbye and thanks for all the fish, which is such an important line that the movie actually opens up with this big, big chorus of all the dolphins leaving Earth singing goodbye and thanks for all the fish. Is a big Busby Berkeley-like production number. It's a wonderful bit. It's only like 45 minutes to an hour into the film that all of a sudden the opening credits come and we hear the music from the Eagles. And oh, just see the movie. It's got about a 15-minute stretch that is dead, but the rest of it is pure to the intent of Douglas Adams. Now, one thing I will say, and something I discussed with Douglas on one of my interviews with him, you noted, I trust, the character of Slarty Bartfast, the designer of Earth. You went to the contractor, and they would, you know, give you somebody who could do designing for you. Slarty Bartfast was sort of at the bottom of the pile. So when they commissioned Earth to be built by these mysterious creatures, it was Slarty Bartfast who got the job, although he won, as you heard, an award for the fjords. Very proud of them he was. He wanted to put them in Africa, but they were moved to Norway and Finland and Scandinavia in general, which he didn't like. Too cold, you know. So, we are now going to follow up with... sidetracking myself. Slarty Bartfast and the designer of Earth and Marvin, the paranoid android. Read a book called The Dimension of Miracles by Robert Sheckley, in which not an android, but a package, a big surprise, or rather prize package, that has the capability of turning into a robot, who is, by the way, rather paranoid, called Marvin, accompanies Carmody, the lead character of the novel, and visit a planet with the guy who worked for a contracting company, designed Earth. And I asked Douglas about that, well, let's be charitable and call it a coincidence. And his answer was simply, oh, I'm very well read. Well, there you go. When Stephen King, or rather Richard Bachman, wrote his novel, The Running Man, I wonder if he had read The Prize of Peril by the same Robert Sheckley. Well, when Sheckley's daughter, who has comes on this program, which will be in about, I think in August, is when she has her next book coming out. Elisa Quitney, her name is. But when she writes science fiction, she uses her father's name, and then it's Elisa Sheckley. In this very small world that we live in, Elisa's mother, Ziva Quitney, is a prominent psychiatrist who worked occasionally, or at least had professional dealings with Dr. Kurt Adler, Margot Adler's father. There's only a few thousand people in the world. In fact, in one Sheckley story, he has to, you know, find somebody who's on Earth. He doesn't know where. And so he's given the opportunity to go to a corner. And he just waits in that corner for about 3 years. And then the person who he was looking for just comes by because there's only that many people on Earth. And they've got to pass at some point, right? Sheckley's humor was very well suited to the humor of Douglas Adams. So without any delay, further delay from me, let's listen to another slightly muddy version. Episode 4 of, well, you know.
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams. Starring Peter Jones as The Book.
Arthur Dent, a perfectly ordinary Earthman, was rather surprised when his friend Ford Prefect suddenly revealed himself to be from a small planet somewhere in the vicinity of Betelgeuse, and not from Guildford after all. He was even more surprised when a few minutes later the Earth was unexpectedly demolished to make way for a new hyperspace bypass. But this was as nothing to their joint surprise when they are rescued from certain death by a stolen spaceship manned by Ford's semi-cousin, the infamous Zephod Beeblebrox, and Trillian, a rather nice astrophysicist Arthur once met at a party in Islington. However, all four of them are soon totally overwhelmed with surprise when they discover that the ancient world of Magrathea, a planet famed in legend for its surprising trade in manufacturing other planets, is not as dead as it was supposed to be. For Zephod, Ford, and Trillian, surprise is pushed to its very limits when this happens. And when Arthur Dent encounters Slati Bartfast, the Magrathean coastline designer, who won an award for his work on Norway, and learns that the whole history of mankind was run for the benefit of a few white mice anyway, surprise is no longer adequate, and he is forced to resort to astonishment.
Mice? What do you mean, mice? I think we must be talking at cross purposes.
These creatures you call mice are not quite as they appear. They are merely the protrusions into our dimension of vast, hyper-intelligent, pan-dimensional beings. The whole business with the cheese and the squeaking is just a front.
A front?
Oh, yes. You see, the mice set up the whole Earth business as an epic experiment in behavioral psychology, in which your planet Earth and its people formed the matrix of an organic computer.
Attention, please. Slati Bartfast, with Slati Bartfast and the visiting Earth creature, please report immediately to the works reception area. Thank you.
However, in the field of management relations, they're absolutely shocking.
Really?
Yes, well, you see, every time they give me an order, I just want to jump on a table and scream.
I can see that would be a problem.
There are, of course, many problems connected with life, of which some of the most popular are, why are people born? Why do they die? And why do they spend so much of the intervening time wearing digital watches? Many millions of years ago, a race of hyper-intelligent, pan-dimensional beings got so fed up with all the constant bickering about the meaning of life, which used to interrupt their favorite pastime of Brocky and Ultra Cricket, a curious game which involved suddenly hitting people for no readily apparent reason and running away, that they decided to sit down and solve the problem once and for all. And to this end, they built themselves a stupendous supercomputer which was so amazingly intelligent that even before its data banks had been connected up, it had started from first principles with, I think, therefore I am, and had got as far as deducing the existence of rice pudding and income tax before anyone managed to turn it off. Could a mere computer solve the problem of life, the universe, and everything? Fortunately for posterity, there exists a tape recording of what transpired when the computer was given this particularly monumental task. Arthur Dent stops off in Slati Bartfast's study to hear it.
What is this great task for which I, deep thought, the second greatest computer in the universe of time and space,
wait a minute,
have been called into existence?
Well, your task, O computer, is to calculate...
This isn't right. Deep thought.
Speak, and I will hear.
Are you not, as we designed you to be, the greatest, most powerful computer in all creation?
I describe myself as the second greatest, and such I am.
But this is preposterous. Are you not a greater computer than the milliard gargantuan brain at Maximegalon, which can count all the atoms in a star in a millisecond?
The milliard gargantuan brain, a mere abacus. Mention it not.
And are you not a more fiendish disputant than a great hyperlobic omnicognate neutron wrangler, which
the
can
great
destroy...
hyperlobic omnicognate neutron wrangler can talk all four legs of an Arcturan megadonkey, but only I can persuade it to go for a walk afterward. Molest me not with this pocket calculator stuff.
Then what's the problem?
I speak of none, but the computer that is to come after me.
Oh, come on. I think this is getting needlessly messianic.
You know nothing of future time. And yet, in my teeming circuitry, I can navigate the infinite delta streams of future probability and see that there must one day come a computer whose merest operational parameters I am not worthy to calculate, but which it will be my destiny eventually to design.
Can we get on and ask the question? Oh, deep thought computer, the task we have designed you to perform is this. We want you to tell us the answer.
The answer? The answer to what?
Life!
The universe!
Everything!
Tricky.
But can you do it?
Yes, I can do it.
You can!
There is an answer? A simple answer?
Yes. Life, the universe, and everything. There is an answer. But I'll have to think about it.
We demand that you can't be
left out. Who are you? What do you want?
I am Magic Thoris.
And I demand that I am Broom Bundle.
It's all right. You don't need to demand that.
All right. I am Broom Bundle, and that is not a demand. That is a solid fact.
Who are you, anyway?
We are philosophers.
Though we may not be.
Yes, we...
We are quite definitely here as representatives of the Amalgamated Union of Philosophers, Sages, Luminaries, and other professional thinking persons.
Mm-hmm.
And we want this machine off, and we want it off now.
Yeah.
By law, the quest for the ultimate truth is quite clearly the unalienable prerogative of your working fingers.
That's right.
I mean, what's the use of our sitting up all night saying there may...
Or may not be.
Or may not be a god if this machine comes along next morning and gives you his telephone number.
We demand rigidly defined areas of doubt and uncertainty.
Might I make an observation at this point?
We demand that that machine not be allowed to think about this problem.
If I might make an observation...
We'll go on strike.
That's right. You'll have a national philosopher's strike on your hands.
Who will that encompass?
Never you mind who it'll inconvenience, you box of blacklegging binary bits. It'll hurt, Buster. It'll hurt.
If I might make an observation, all I want to say is that my circuits are now irrevocably committed to computing the answer to life, the universe, and everything.
Ah, but, come on.
But the program will take me 7.5 million years to run.
7.5 million years?
Yes, I said I'd have to think about it, didn't I? And it occurs to me that running a program like this is bound to cause sensational public interest. And so, any philosophers who are quick off the mark are going to clean up in the prediction business.
Prediction business?
Obviously. You just get on the pundit circuit. You all go on the chat shows and the color supplements and violently disagree with each other about what answer I'm eventually going to produce. And if you get yourselves clever agents, you'll be on the gravy train for life.
Bloody hell, now that's what I call thinking. Here, Vroom Fondle, why do we never think of things like that?
Dunno. Think our minds must be too highly trained, Magic Thighs.
But I don't understand what all this has got to do with the Earth and mice and things.
All will become clear to you, Earthman. Are you not anxious to hear what the computer had to say 7.5 million years later?
Oh, well, yes, of course. Quite.
Here is the recording of the events of that fateful day.
I'd like to hear.
O people who wait in the shadow of deep thought, honored descendants of Rune Fondle and Magic Thighs, the greatest and most truly interesting pundits the universe has ever known, the time of waiting is over! 7.5 million years our race has waited for this great and hopefully enlightening day, the day of the answer! Never again will we wake up in the morning and think, who am I? What is my purpose in life? Does it really, cosmically speaking, matter if I don't get up and go to work? Or today we will finally learn, once and for all, the plain and simple answer to all these nagging little problems of life, the universe, and everything. We can enjoy our game of Brockian ultra cricket in the firm and comfortable knowledge that the meaning of life is now well and truly sorted out.
75,000 generations ago, our ancestors set this program in motion.
An awesome prospect. Deep Thought prepares to speak.
Good evening.
Good evening, old Deep Thought. Do you have...
An answer for you? Yes, I have.
There really is one.
There really is one.
To everything? To the great question of life, the universe, and everything?
Yes.
And are you ready to give it to us?
I am.
Now?
Now.
Wow.
Though I don't think you're going to like it.
It doesn't matter. We must know it.
Now?
Yes, now.
All right.
Well?
You're really not going to like it.
Tell us.
All right. The answer to everything.
Yes?
Life, the universe, and everything.
Yes?
Is.
Yes?
Is.
Yes?
42.
We are going to get lynched, you know that.
It was a tough assignment.
42?
I think the problem such as it was too broadly based. You never actually stated what the question was.
But it was the ultimate question, the question of life, the universe, and everything.
Well, exactly. Now you know that the answer to the ultimate question of life, the universe, and everything is 42. All you need to do now is find out what the ultimate question is.
All right. Can you please tell us the question?
The ultimate question?
Yes.
Of life, the universe...
And everything?
And everything.
Yes.
Tricky.
But can you do it?
No.
Oh, God.
But I'll tell you who can.
Who? Tell us. Who is...
I speak of none. The computer that is to come after me.
What computer?
A computer whose nearest operational parameters I am not worthy to calculate, and yet I will design it for you. A computer which can calculate the question to the ultimate answer. A computer of such infinite and subtle complexity that organic life itself will form part of its operational matrix. And it shall be called the Earth.
Oh, what a dull name.
So there you have it. Deep Thought designed it, we built it, and you lived on it.
And the Vogons came and destroyed it 5 minutes before the program was completed.
Yes. 10 million years of planning and work gone. Just like that. Well, that's bureaucracy for you.
You know, all this explains a lot of things. All through my life, I've had this strange, unaccountable feeling that something was going on in the world. And no one would tell me what it was.
No, that's just perfectly normal paranoia. Everyone in the universe has that.
Well, perhaps it means that somewhere outside...
Maybe. Who cares? Perhaps I'm old and tired, but I always think that the chances of finding out what really is going on are so absurdly remote that the only thing to do is to say, hang the sense of it and just... keep yourself occupied. Look at me, I design coastlines. I got an award for Norway. Where's the sense in that? None that I've been able to make out. I've been doing fjords all my life. For a fleeting moment, they become fashionable, and I get a major award. In this replacement Earth we're building, they've given me Africa to do, and of course I'm doing it with all fjords again, because I happen to like them. And I'm old-fashioned enough to think that they give a lovely baroque feel to a continent. And they tell me it's not equatorial enough. What does it matter? Science has achieved some wonderful things, of course, but I'd far rather be happy than right any day.
And are you?
No. That's where it all falls down, of course.
Pity. It sounded like quite a good lifestyle otherwise.
Attention, please, Slotty Buttfast. Would Slotty Buttfast and the visiting Earth creature please report immediately? Repeat immediately to the works reception area. Come on, you guys. The mice aren't wanting to hang about in this dimension all day.
Come on, I suppose we'd better go and see what they want.
I seem to be having this tremendous difficulty with my lifestyle. As soon as I reach some kind of definite policy about what is my kind of music and my kind of restaurant and my kind of overdraft, people start blowing up my kind of planet and throwing me out of their kind of spaceships. It's so hard to build up anything coherent. Oh, I'm sorry, all this must sound rather fatuous to you.
Yes, I thought so.
Just forget I ever said it.
It is, of course, well known that careless talk costs lives, but the full scale of the problem is not always appreciated. For instance, at the very moment that Arthur Dent said, "I seem to be having this tremendous difficulty with my lifestyle," a freak wormhole opened up in the fabric of the space-time continuum and carried his words far, far back in time across almost infinite reaches of space to a distant galaxy where strange and warlike beings were poised on the brink of frightful interstellar battle. The two opposing leaders were meeting for the last time, and a dreadful silence fell across the conference table as the commander of the Blahergs, resplendent in his black jeweled battle shorts, gazed levelly at the Gogogvant leader squatting opposite him in a cloud of green, sweet-smelling steam, and with a million sleek and horribly beweaponed star cruisers poised to unleash electric death at his single word of command, challenged the vile creature to take back what it had said about his mother. The creature stirred in his sickly broiling vapor, and at that very moment, the words,
"I seem to be having this tremendous difficulty with my lifestyle,"
drifted across the conference table. Unfortunately, in the Blaherg tongue, this was the most dreadful insult imaginable, and there was nothing for it but to wage terrible war. Eventually, of course, it was realized that the whole thing had been a ghastly mistake, and so the two opposing battle fleets settled their few remaining differences in order to launch a joint attack on our galaxy, now positively identified as the source of the offending remark. For thousands more years, the mighty ships tore across the empty wastes of space and finally dived screaming onto the planet Earth, where, due to a terrible miscalculation of scale, the entire battle fleet was accidentally swallowed by a small dog. Those who study the complex interplay of cause and effect in the history of the universe say that this sort of thing is going on all the time, but are powerless to prevent it. It's just life, they say. Meanwhile, Arthur Dent is about to discover the answer to the disturbing question posed in last week's installment. Are his companions, Ford, Zaphod, and Trillian, lying bleeding to death in a subterranean corridor? Or have they merely slipped out for a quick meal somewhere?
Arthur, you're safe.
Am I? Oh, good.
Hi, Arthur. Come and join us.
What happened to you?
Well, our hosts here sort of attacked us with a fantastic dismodulating anti-phase stun ray and then invited us to this amazingly keen meal by way of making it up to us.
Hosts? What hosts? I can't see any hosts.
Welcome to lunch, Earth creature.
What? Who said that? Oh, there's a mouse on the table.
Oh, haven't you found out yet, Arthur?
Found out what? I see, yes. Oh, yes. I just wasn't quite prepared for the full reality of it.
Arthur, let me introduce you. This is Benji Mouse.
Hi.
Hi.
And this is Frankie, Mouse.
Nice to meet you.
It seems they control quite a large sector of the universe in our dimension.
But aren't they...
Yes, they are the mice I took with me from the Earth. It seems our whole journey has been stage-managed from the beginning.
Excuse me.
Yes, thank you, Slotty Buttfast. You may go.
Oh. Very well, thank you, sir. I'll just go and get on with some of my fjords, then.
In fact, that won't be necessary.
What?
We won't be requiring the new Earth after all. We've had this rather interesting proposition put to us.
You can't mean that. I've got 1,000 glaciers poised and ready to roll over Africa.
Well, perhaps you can take a quick skiing holiday before you dismantle them.
Skiing holiday? Those glaciers are works of art. Elegantly sculpted contours, soaring pinnacles of ice, deep, majestic ravines. It would be sacrilege to go skiing on high art.
Thank you, Slarky Barker. That will be all.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Well, goodbye, Earthman. I hope the lifestyle comes together.
Goodbye, then. Sorry about the fjords.
Now, Earth creature, we have, as you know, been more or less running your planet for the last 10 million years in order to find this wretched thing called the ultimate question.
Why?
No, we already thought of that one, but it doesn't fit the answer.
No, I mean, why have you been doing it?
Eventually just habit, I think, to be brutally honest. And this is more or less the point. We are sick to the teeth of the whole thing. And the prospect of doing it all over again on account of those Winnet-ridden Vogons, quite frankly, gives me the screaming heebie-jeebies. You know what I mean. We've been offered a quite enormously fat contract to do the 5DTV chat show and lecture circuit. And I'm very much inclined to take it.
I would, wouldn't you, Ford?
Oh, yes, jump at it like a shot.
But that's exactly the attitude those philosophers took. Does no one in this galaxy do anything other than appear on chat shows?
The point is this. We are in a position to give you a very important commission. We still want to find the ultimate question because it gives us a lot of bargaining muscle with the 5D TV companies. So it's worth a lot of money. quite clearly, if we're sitting there in the studio mentioning that we happen to know the answer to life, the universe and everything, and then eventually have to admit that it's 42, then I think the show is probably quite short.
Yes, but doesn't that mean you've got to go through your whole 10-million-year program again?
We think there might be a shortcut. We've been offered a quite enormously fat contract to do the 5DTV chat show and lecture circuit. And I'm very much inclined to take it.
I would, wouldn't you, Ford?
Oh, yes, jump at it like a shot.
But that's exactly the attitude those philosophers took. Does no one in this galaxy do anything other than appear on chat shows?
The point is this. We are in a position to give you a very important commission. We still want to find the ultimate question because it gives us a lot of bargaining muscle with the 5DTV companies. So it's worth a lot of money. quite clearly, if we're sitting there in the studio mentioning that we happen to know the answer to life, the universe and everything, and then eventually have to admit that it's 42, then I think the show is probably quite short.
Yes, but doesn't that mean you've got to go through your whole 10-million-year program again?
We think there might be a shortcut. Your agent has...
That's me.
Is it?
Your agent has suggested that both you and ourselves, as last-generation products of the computer matrix, are probably in an ideal position to find the question for us and find it quickly. Go out and find it, and we'll make you a reasonably rich man.
We're holding out for extremely rich.
All right, extremely rich. You drive a hard bargain, Beeblebrox. Bells, what is it now?
Emergency, emergency. Hospital ship has landed on planet. Intruders now in the works reception area. Defense stations, defense stations. Come on, you guys. What are you nuts? Get out of there.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking?
Police. Hell and bats loom. We've got to get out.
Police?
Yeah, it's this wretched spacecraft we stole, and I left them a note explaining how they could make a profit on the insurance claim, but it doesn't seem to have worked.
Oh, come on then, let's move.
Earthman, find us a question.
How?
No, that doesn't work either.
We will find it. Come on, get out of here.
Thanks for the meal, guys. Sorry we've got to run.
Which way, Zaphod?
At a wild guess, I'd say down here.
Come on, let's go.
Okay, Beeblebrox. Hold it right there. We've got you covered.
You want to try a guess at all, Paul?
Okay, this way.
Yeah.
All right, okay.
We don't want to shoot you, Beeblebrox.
Shoot me fine.
We cornered.
Oh, hell. I think I've dropped my adrenaline pills. All right. Behind this computer bank. Get down.
Hey, they're shooting at us.
Yeah.
I thought they said they didn't want to do that.
Yeah, I thought they said that.
Hey, I thought you said you didn't want to shoot us.
It isn't easy. Cop.
What did he say?
He said it isn't easy being a cop.
Well, surely that's his problem, isn't it?
I'd have thought so.
Hey, listen. I think we've got enough problems of our own with you shooting at us, so if you could avoid laying your personal problems on us as well, I think we'd probably find it easier to cope.
Now, see here, buddy. You're not dealing with any dumb, two-bit trigger-pumping morons with low hairlines, little piggy eyes, and no conversation.
Nah.
We're a couple of intelligent, caring guys who you'd probably like if you met us socially.
That's right. I'm really sensitive.
Who are these guys?
I think I preferred it when they were shooting.
So are you going to come quietly or are you going to
Which would you rather?
You still there?
Yes.
We didn't enjoy doing that at all.
People Brax, either you all give yourselves up now and let us beat you up a bit. Though not very much, of course, because we are firmly opposed to needless violence.
Get against it.
We blow up this entire planet, possibly one or two others we noticed on our way out here.
But that's crazy. You wouldn't blow up this entire planet just to get a bloody spaceship back.
Oh, yes, we would. I think we would. Wouldn't we?
Oh, yeah, we'd have to, no question.
But why?
Tell her.
Because there are some things you got to do, even if you aren't. And like a liberal cop who knows all about sensitivity and everything.
This is true.
I just don't believe these guys.
Shall we shoot them again for a bit?
Yeah, why not?
We're not going to be safe behind this computer bank for much longer, fellas. It's been really nice knowing you. I just want to say that.
Yeah, it's really been great. And it was really nice bumping into you again.
Yeah,
the computer bank is absorbing a hell of a lot of energy. I think it's about to blow.
It's a shame we never managed to get the work done revising the book. I thought it looked rather promising.
Yeah.
What book? The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh, that thing.
Look, I hate to say this, Lance, but this thing really is going to blow up.
Okay.
Assuming our heroes survive this latest reversal in their fortunes, will they find somewhere reasonably interesting to go now? Will Arthur Dent or Trillium manage to find the question to the ultimate answer? Who will they meet at the restaurant at the end of the universe? Find out in next week's exciting installment of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
In that episode of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Peter Jones was the book. Richard Vernon was Slaty Bartfast. Simon Jones played Arthur Dent. Jeffrey McGiven, Ford Prefect and Deep Thought, Mark Wing Davies, Zaphod Beeblebrox, Susan Sheridan, Trillian, Jonathan Adams, Magic Thighs and the Cheerleader, Ray Hassett, the first computer programmer, Bang Bang and PA Voice, Jeremy Brown, second computer programmer, James Broadbent, Vroom Fondle and Shooty, Peter Hawkins, Frankie Mouse, and David Tate, Benji Mouse. The ultimate answer to life, the universe, and everything was revealed by kind permission of the Amalgamated Union of Philosophers, Sages, Luminaries, and other professional thinking persons. The program was written by Douglas Adams and produced by Jeffrey Perkins, with the assistance of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop.
Okay, again, sorry for the quality of that sound, but thanks for all the fish. I do have to give you a spoiler, because we heard all about Deep Thought. We heard all about the computer that has been working for so many millions of years that the two mice commissioned and all that, and they had to come up with... Well, they came up with the question, or the answer, and they, of course, had to come up with the question of life, the universe, and everything. But I'm sorry, I will give you the spoiler. 42. And if you'd like to donate to WBAI in honor of being the first station in the U.S. to broadcast a much better version, much better quality version of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, pledge $42. There's an idea. Just make a phone call to 516-620-3602 or become a BAI buddy. That's only $10 a month. And or $51 for the 51 years, help me, that I have been working here at WBAI. But make a pledge. Do that for us, would you? I've one more week. I'm doing very, very light pitching. I am not regaling you with why you've got to donate money and all this and that. What I'm doing is I'm bringing you programming. This is the old style method of pitching, is make the programs so good that people simply have to donate, that they have to give, because the stuff is so good. Well, with all due respect, the stories I have been telling, not about me, but about, you know, the history of BAI and stuff like that there. It's worth that money. Do it for us. Do it for yourself. Make sure that we are around. Give to WBAI.org. I really don't care if you use the word two or the number two. You will find, and anybody who goes on the air and says, oh, you got to use the number two, it's like, use the word two. It'll work just as well. And you don't have to say, give number two, WBAI.org, and then people type in number, N-U-M-B-E-R. It really happens. It really happens. Just give to WBAI.org. Or here's another idea. Just go to WBAI.org. You will see a nice big button there that says, give money. And that will take you to give to WBAI.org. It all goes to the same stomach. So do that or else call and pledge at 516-620-3602. I will find other cleaner copies of some Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and next time I'll play episodes 1 and 2. But I do hope that you enjoyed episodes 3 and 4. They are a lot of fun. The asides, the writing, the acting, it's just all so brilliant. And for all the many, many versions of Hitchhiker's Guide that there have been, from the movie to the TV series to the actually rather good TV series. There were two TV series of Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. One was British and one was American, or that is to say Canadian, done by Max Landis. And the latter one was brilliant, was wonderful. The British one sucked. The American one was good. How often does that happen? Well, it happened that time anyway. So, with all that noted, next week on this program, our guest will be Mimi Mondal, a person whose voice you've probably not heard on these airwaves before, but she is a relatively new writer coming up on the fantasy and science fiction landscape, and she's very interesting. Google her, M-O-N-D-A-L, first name Mimi, M-I-M-I. She's got a lot to say, so hope to see you then. In the meantime, have a good week. Enjoy Towel Day on Friday, something definitely worth celebrating. A preferred holiday. It's like Talk Like a Pirate Day. It has the same kind of importance. So they could combine those two. Talk like a pirate and carry your towel, right? Good. Thank you for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Visit me on Facebook in the Hour of the Wolf group or at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings group. See you on June 5th for that, by the way. And for the Thomas M. Dish tribute, stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers coming your way with Lister momentarily. I will do Facebook Live next week. Didn't seem like there was any point to it this week. But again, take care. Be good and be good to each other. Good morning.
that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the red, white, and blue spit on you.
Expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Burn the material of the imperialist in a blazing inferno. Cause my hurt is internal. The American dream, a nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies the pigs make up. Imperialistic swines that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison cause I'm busy attacking the flag. I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fascists and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Number one,
Panama. Talking about Peru. Azania. Brixton. Belfast. Can't forget Korea. Beirut. Can't forget Haiti. Iran. Puerto Rico. Colombia. Mexico, talking about uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all, and Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami, do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville, boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail and now they got him in court because he burned the flag.
Number one.
That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. The free boom. This is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you.
yeah. 99 Sinclair, list alive. WBAI. Pacifica Radio, that's very best right there. Black burning time, make it 5 minutes. After 3 o'clock, we do this every Thursday. Yeah, burn, baby burn. Clappers, yeah. List alive, 99 Sinclair. Yeah, right here at your favorite radio station, WBAI. Yeah. We are asking you to pledge as much as you can right here at 99 Sinclair, WBAI. Give to WBAI.org. Yeah. Toronto, Canada, we got your favorite Baby Sham right here on the radio. Yo. The Hand family. Yeah. 99 Cinco.
I remember those days, hey, when hell was my home, hey, when me and mama bed was a big piece of foam. And me never like bathe and my ear never comb. When mama gonna work me, go street go roam. I remember when Danny them get my snow cone and make him lick a bread at them, kick up Jerome. I remember when we visit them with pure big stone and the boy Danny pop out something we're full chrome. I remember when we run, but I get him knee blown and my best friend Richie get doing I'm done. I remember Sunday Avenue turn in a war zone and Mikey mother fly mode, cause she get alone. Hey. Mikey got too far in and got on Al Capone. Make one leap of money and send me no one. Now we all at the city and that is well known. Yesterday Mikey called me from my phone. Me say Mikey, we get the thing them, them out of luck now. We squeeze seven and the whole of them are duck now. Me a bully for extra, cause we not rock now.
We got the kingdom, so we have to make way. We take it from the bottom to the top, baby. And now the whole community can live greatly. I remember those days when we was dead broken. I could barely find a dollar for a token. Hop in the train just to get where I'm going. Popo's after me, I'm running like I'm smoking. Remember those days when I went to bed hungry. All I ever ate was white rice and honey. Big dreams in my head, empty my tummy. Might crack a smile, but ain't nothing funny. I remember playing over needles in the streets. Everywhere I go, a man wants some part of me. Dirty, dirty, those hookers and hoes on 11th Avenue selling bodies for
keys, y'all.
Remember crying, saying that we'll never be me. Yeah. Gonna make it someday, gotta please somebody. Say, mommy, don't worry, it's just you and me. But one day we will get out of this misery.
Hey, we got the kingdom, them out of luck now. Me squeeze seven and the whole of them are duck now. We have only but extra, cause we not broke now.
We got the kingdom, so they have to make way. We take it from the bottom to the top, baby. And now the whole community can live greatly. Here's my ghetto story.
99 Cinco, list alive, Alicia Keys, write yourself. Burn, baby, burn, clappers. Now you gotta do the buddy system. $10 a month will do the trick. $20 a month will do the trick. $50 a month will do the trick. Just go to give to WBAI.org. Toronto. Crooklyn.
Rich now, so them can't tell man nothing.
Strong Island.
We are men, money and fish and mutton.
Yeah.
Hey, over there, so make me tell you no something.
Yeah.
Show me they are far in the water.
99 synchronist alive. So we do it, yeah.
Anytime I fly down with him, I get more
than one. One.
Listen. Girl on a bus. The doctor, I feel her up. Me said the doctor, I feel her up.
To the driver.
She said the driver rich. She said the doctor rich. She said him have enough girl, but him pocket thick. She have a man at home, but he is a clown. Him call her phone. I ask how she no reach home. She a take her own time. I fetchy. Don't a turn. From seat she want to sit down. Pay which fear, and she's a brown. Plus her body weigh 100 pounds. Now down to the blind man, them a come round. She get enough money still, sir, but she get it in a silver. She said the driver rich. She said the doctor rich. She said him have enough girl, but him pocket big. She have a man at home, but he is a clown. Him call her
your touch. First gear, second gear gone up. Driver, mind your crash, please look where you go. The doctor count money till him weak. He must two gal on the front seat. A bad man gal say,
money you are use, man gal. Take it, fix the teeth.
The doctor say, grasses moves. She said the driver rich. She said the doctor rich. She said him have enough gal, but him pocket big. She have a man at home, but he is a clown. Him call her phone, I ask how she no reach home. She a take her own time. Affetchy, affetchy. Don't a turn, don't a turn, don't a turn. From seat, she want to sit down. Pay which fear, as she's a brown. Plus her body weigh 100 pound. Now young to the blind man, them a come round. She get enough money still, sir, but she get it in a silver. She said the driver rich. She said the doctor rich. She said he have enough girl, but him back is big.
No,
she
has
a man.
'99 Cinco, Clap Pies, Burn, Baby Burn, yeah. Listen, your weekend starts right now on the newest side of Kismet Beach in Strong Island, yeah. Endless Summer Part 1. Listen, congratulations. I hear you. I hear you graduating on Thursday. Cinco.